Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, independent journalist Dar Jamail told the truth about the Iraq War. Now he's telling the truth about the climate crisis, and yep, the news is even worse. I hope you'll stay tuned. Dar Jamail was just a citizen from Houston, by way of Alaska, who decided to travel to Iraq to see and write about what the 2003 war was really like. He spent 8 months there in 2003 and 2006. The reporters for the corporate media were all, quote, embedded, unquote, with American military units. And all of them wrote and broadcast nothing but pro-war, jingoistic, imperialist propaganda in service to the U.S. war machine. Meanwhile, Dar Jamail was on his own, writing about what he actually saw. Needless to say, he had a devil of a time finding anyone to publish his dispatches. He did begin to get some recognition when his book was published in 2007, Beyond the Green Zone. And a very good book it was. His reporting earned him the Martha Gellhorn Award and also the Izzy Award for Independent Journalism. Dar is still alive and still doing first-hand reporting. His new focus is the climate crisis, and his new book of 2019 is titled The End of Ice. I said the climate crisis is his new focus, not his new subject. For, in a way, his larger subject is the same as in his Iraq reporting. The larger subject is, in Dar's own words, how the sledgehammer of empire works in practice. He spoke in Syracuse, New York, on April 11, 2019. The talk is long and wide-ranging, and, I might add, beautifully recorded and edited by Wilton Vaught, producer of the series Essential Dissent. I'm going to condense this long talk a bit and broadcast it again in two or maybe three installments of New World Notes. Today, in part one, Dar talks of his attraction to Mount Denali in Alaska, then U.S. war crimes in Fallujah, Iraq, Native American versus European beliefs and values, then off to the Pacific's dying reefs in Guam and Australia. And yes, it's all connected. Here is Dar Jamail.
Thanks everyone very, very much for coming out tonight. And I too would like to acknowledge that we are on indigenous land that was taken forcefully, and to thank the indigenous people who lived here and were stewards of this land for thousands and thousands of years before first contact. As Ed just mentioned, I was living in Alaska from 1996 onwards for about 10 years and was a social worker in between climbing seasons, and then during summers I was up on Denali climbing, guiding, and then finally volunteering as a rescue ranger. And I bring that up because I started my journalism work as a war reporter, but the seeds of this book were planted in 1996, the first time I laid eyes on Denali, because for me, seeing that mountain, it was love at first sight, which didn't make a whole bunch of sense for a guy born and raised in Houston, Texas, but there you have it. Enough so that I moved up there, oriented my whole life just around how can I be up in the mountains and learning to climb and then getting into it. And I mention all this because it's a really important part of the story, and it's a really important part of this book for me, and it's a really important part of the message that I want to bring to you tonight. So I was on Denali when the Iraq War was on. I remember being up in the mountains, first the Chugach Range outside of Anchorage during the invasion, listening to it on the radio, sick to my stomach, horrified like probably just about everybody in this room. And then the next month going up on Denali, as I did usually for May and June, and having the same experience. And I can remember being high up on the mountain and just being glued to the radio and wondering what else to do. I didn't know what else to do. I had done what probably a lot of people had done of the usual things we're supposed to do to express our dissent towards the government to no avail. And so something came to me up there, which was, you need to just go. I'm passionate about people having accurate information, and so I decided to just go to Iraq and start writing about it. That was a little bit over 16 years ago, and here I am. But what I found in Iraq, once I really caught my stride as a journalist and went into Fallujah during the April siege in 2004, and writing about what was happening and the gory details, because I think it's important to know the gory details, and I'm going to talk about some of those regarding the climate crisis tonight. And in Fallujah, I was literally watching with my own eyes American snipers intentionally shooting women, elderly, and young people. And one thing they did, it's horrific, but it's important to mention to show that things don't change in regards to how the sledgehammer of empire operates. One tactic they used was young boys, usually between the ages of 12 and 16, snipers were intentionally shooting them in between the legs. This was one tactic used, along with many other terroristic tactics used by the American military in Fallujah. And a big lesson for me was writing for lefty outlets that I wrote a story about this and I couldn't get it published. And so that's when I learned I had to go further to the fringe of the lefty outlets to publish things like this. And I bring that up because I've been having a similar experience regarding the climate crisis. I've been reporting on it now since 2010, and on a monthly basis, literally every single month since 2013. And so I wanted to bring that up because I think it's very, very important for us, as hard as the information is that I'm going to share tonight in regards to what's happening to the planet and what's already baked into the system, we have to have an accurate map. You know, and so the analogy that I like to use is if you're planning a camping trip or a backcountry trip, do you not want the most accurate map available to plan your trip, even if it means you're going to have to take a different route or not be able to go to a certain area or make some pretty dramatic changes? Of course, you're going to want an accurate map. So in 2013, I wrote an article where I essentially connected all the dots on the climate crisis and understood how far along we already were. And for me, it was one thing to report on just what's happening to the oceans or just what's happening to the forests or what's happening to the glaciers around the world. But then when they were pulled all together and I interviewed several scientists about the bigger picture and feedback loops and things, I basically had a very full-on experience of going back through the depression stage of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. Now, obviously, as a reporter, I was at least largely beyond the denial stage and a lot of the time beyond the anger stage. But the depression after that article really, really was too much to bear. And for about 3 months, I was living in Doha, Qatar, writing for Al Jazeera English, and was on my couch in a fetal position, literally, at times, really understanding, okay, we are in it deep. Now what? And then, of course, I had to learn, you know, okay, where do we go from here after taking this in? And I wrote an article on this almost a year ago, and I want to just read from the beginning of it tonight. Just for context, one thing that I have struggled with, knowing people personally, some in my own family that don't believe climate change or support Trump or support these people. And one thing that I've struggled with even recently, especially looking at how far along we are in the crisis, and then having this administration where it's as though these people are literally just trying to kill the planet as fast as they can, and struggling to understand this, especially looking at they're married, they have kids, they have grandkids. How does that work? How does that just doesn't compute to me? You know, stepping out of overtly political analysis of that, which most people in here are probably familiar with. I finally came across, through an indigenous elder friend, something that helped me understand it better, and I want to just read a few paragraphs of what I wrote about this. It's from a story I wrote called For Native Americans, History Continues to Repeat Itself. Professor Emeritus and former chair of the Native American Studies at University of California, Davis, Jack Forbes, writes in his book, Columbus and Other Cannibals, of what he calls the sickness of exploitation, or the Wetiko cannibal disease. Cannibalism, as Forbes defines it, is the consuming of another's life for one's own private purpose or profit. Forbes notes, imperialism and exploitation are forms of cannibalism, and in fact are precisely those forms of cannibalism which are most diabolical or evil. He adds, few, if any, societies on the face of the earth have been as avaricious, cruel, violent, and aggressive as have certain European populations. Native Americans experienced Wetiko in brutal fashion not long after, quote, first contact, end quote, with Europeans. I also interviewed a man for this piece named Harold Dick Jr. He's a 72-year-old Chiricahua Apache, lives in southern New Mexico. And he said of this, Europeans slaughtered during one short period alone 50 million buffalo because thousands of us relied on them. And in less than a generation, they annihilated them. And they take pride in this and take pictures of the dead buffalo, like it takes a real man to shoot an animal with a high-powered rifle from far away. He added that when Native Americans talk about great people, they usually speak of medicine people. Quote, but all the greats the whites ever write about were great at destruction and subjugating people. So for me, that has helped me to understand the fact that these people in these positions of power, usually white men, almost all white men, we know that they're fossil fuel funded. We know about the Koch brothers. We understand all of this. But I think we need to go deeper than that, which is despite all of the political and the financial reasons and how real politic is operating in this country today, that from Jack Forbes's perspective, these people are basically sociopaths. They're a danger to themselves and others, even people in their own family and their loved ones, and they're a danger to the planet, and they need to be treated accordingly. And I think that needs to be factored in a little later in the talk and during the Q&A when we start talking about where do we go from here. So what I did for this book, much like what I did for this book, it was essentially, I didn't think about it consciously, but it was basically the same formula, which is I want to go to the front lines and really see what's going on and taste it and touch it and feel it and write about it as in as personal way as possible, as well as go with the leading scientists I could find studying those particular areas, and ideally scientists that had long-term intimate relationships with the areas they were studying. And so I went to South Florida for sea level rise, back to Denali and other places in Alaska and Glacier National Park for glaciers, the Amazon rainforest, several forests across the West to write about what's happening to trees, and to Australia, to the Great Barrier Reef, to write about what's happening to reefs, and then two different locations to really focus in on how indigenous populations are being impacted. Because as we know, like other crises around the planet, those that are taking it, usually the first and the hardest on the chin are indigenous populations, people of color, and the poor. So where I would like to take us first is to Australia, and I want to start with just talking about the magnificence of this area. The Great Barrier Reef is 1,400 miles long. It's the largest reef on the planet, visible from space. It's home to more than 1,500 species of fish, 6 of the world's 7 species of threatened marine turtles, 30 marine mammals, 134 species of sharks and rays, and 411 types of hard coral, and 1/3 of the world's soft corals. Right before I went there, I stopped off in Guam, where I met with Lori Raimondo. She's a professor at the University of Guam Marine Lab, and she'd lived out there since 2004. Dr. Raimondo is also co-author of the 2016 Paris Climate Agreement. So what's happening with Coral and why I wanted to highlight it in this book is important for a lot of reasons. And what we're seeing now and what I think probably many of you have already read in the news is these major coral bleaching events that are happening around the planet. So for those that aren't as familiar with it, coral bleaching, you know, coral exists in a certain temperature range. And the beautiful colors the coral gets are from algae that the coral gets its protein from. And when the water, however, gets too warm, that algae becomes toxic to the coral ejects it, and then it turns basically bone bleach white, and that means it's in the process of starving. If the water cools back down within 3 to 4 weeks, typically the coral can take that algae back in and it can survive. If it doesn't cool down enough in time, then the coral will die. And that's what has started to become very prevalent as the oceans warm further and further. And so I talked to Dr. Raimondo about this, and I just want to read a short bit out of the book of what she said, because she has been a coral ecologist out there for a long time, and she's been monitoring water quality, coastal development, the overabundance of crown of thorn starfish that can decimate reefs, and overfishing out there over the last decade. These have all caused coral loss, but these elements have stabilized. And then she said, but warming water has all of a sudden exploded in the bleaching. In the history of anyone looking at this, we've never had bleaching events as severe as the last couple of years. She's talking about Guam, but this applies to Australia as well. She sees the massive problems besetting Guam's reefs as a confluence of two large bleaching events in a row, followed by low tide exposure of corals for successive months, then a coral disease outbreak in 2016 that she thinks it is in part at least to the warming waters. We don't know how many populations that affected, but there are at least two that we know a disease just wiped them out in 1 week. We don't know what causes a lot of these. Some flare up, the coral gets stressed, maybe from heat, and something that wasn't necessarily a problem then becomes a problem. There is a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Report that was published in 2011 that said the current trajectory of pollution, warming oceans, climate disruption, everything going as it was, fossil fuel emissions, that there would likely be no functioning coral reefs left anywhere on the planet by 2050. And I talked to Lori and her colleague out there, Dave Burdick. They work together at University of Guam. He's also a coral biologist. And I asked him about that report. She says the study is evidence that pristine reefs around the world are no longer going to be areas of protection since oceanic heating is now a global phenomenon. Quote, we are finding that reefs living under anthropogenic stresses for many years have already lost their more sensitive coral species. And the ones that are there now are already the tough bastards, as she put it. And when reefs have lower diversity, there is less ecological redundancy, hence they are more likely to collapse. She and her colleague Burdick both believe that Guam's coral reefs carry a message for the world. The Chamorro people, the indigenous people of the Mariana Islands, including Guam, have a strong cultural affinity with the reefs and the fish they provide. Loss of the reefs would mean a critical loss of identity for the Chamorro. Quote, these are reefs that thousands of people use for fishing or cultural identity and recreational use, and these are all going to be significantly threatened. The year before I spoke with Burdick and Raimondo, Guam had seen 1.5 million visitors, with the majority of them tourists attracted to the crystal clear water and beaches. Quote, people coming here are going to know structure versus rubble, color versus no color, fish versus no fish, Raimondo says. Over time, all that is going to go away if there is no coral and there are no fish. From there, I went on to Australia and the Great Barrier Reef. I'd been there before in the past, almost 20 years prior diving, and was struck there, like other places I went working on this chapter, like Guam and Palau, at the dramatic reduction in the number of fish and sharks on the reef, as well as a notable difference in the amount of healthy coral that I saw. So I went out onto the Great Barrier Reef with a man named John Rumney. He's actually a salty American waterman who's lived in Australia for almost 50 years. And he had founded an NGO called Great Barrier Reef Legacy with an Australian marine scientist named Dr. Dean Miller. When I met John Rumney, he's very sparkly blue eyes, especially when he talks about the reef. He's usually running around in a bathing suit because he's almost always out on the reef. He's always very excited to talk about it. And when I met him and started talking about him and got the initial, okay, who are you? What are you doing out here? You know, where are you from? Where you live? And he says, I live on the reef, not in Australia. He wanted to point that out. So I want to read a couple of pages to finish this bit talking about the reefs from my time out on the reef with both of these guys. So we went out on a snorkeling tour to the outer reef. They were showing me different sites, and that's the setting of this. After about an hour at one site, we climb back into the boat, which then takes us a short way to a site that John Rumney refers to as SNO, which is right near the outer reef. He is excited to get into the water. This area used to be at 110% wellness, he says, smiling as he pulls on his gear. I know that's not real scientific to say that, but we used to have life growing atop life here. But this area was also impacted last year, so I'm curious to see what condition it's in today. We slip into the clear water, snorkel a short way over to the shallower reef area, and I'm taken aback by the decimation. At least half of the coral is already dead, covered in slimy algae or bleached white. At one point, I swim for 5 minutes straight and see nothing but dead or bleached coral. I look over at Rumney. He had raved about this spot, but I'm unable to find an area that isn't, at least in part, bleached, dead, or covered in algae. Even in the deeper areas, many of which remain largely intact, still have signs of bleaching. During a visit to the reef in 1996, I'd taken part in a liveaboard scuba diving trip, which found me diving 20 times over multiple days across the reef. Compared to what I'd seen then, there was notably less coral in many areas, and as in Palau, far fewer fish. I swim on. The coralscape still holds an austere beauty. Fill in the vibrant colors and add myriad fish of all species and sizes, and you'd have what it used to be. I swim along in dismay. The odds are low I'll return to Australia anytime soon, and since it is unlikely to survive another 13 years, I am effectively saying goodbye to the Great Barrier Reef. Back in the boat, Dean Miller says, it's at least half gone, even way out here. We eat lunch while the boat motors to the third site, which Rumney refers to as Mojo. I slip into the water alone, just wanting one-on-one time with the reef. Thankfully, this site is in comparatively good shape. The colors of the coral shimmer. Schools of fish abound. Giant underwater islands of coral stretch tens of feet toward the surface, with coral growing atop coral, life growing on life. Giant blue stag coral grows straight out of 10-foot-wide brown table coral. It is stupendous. The water crackles with the sounds of fish biting coral and the clicking sounds of shrimp. Yet even here I come across dead zones. As I enter one, my surroundings fall silent. The bottom holds larger swaths of long-dead stag coral covered in slimy, deep brown algae. Conscious that my time on the reef is limited, I swim out of the dead area and find another vibrant area. I stay there alone, soaking it all in. I feel time slipping away. Giant clams, anemone, table corals growing atop table corals, sponges, starfish, hard and soft corals, all the colors of the spectrum fill the water. My heart swells and I never want to leave. I dive down deep, holding my breath as long as I can until I become lightheaded, then surface again for more air. I do it again, swimming down 20, 30, 40 feet in places, equalizing my ears as I dive 2, 3, 4 times as I swim downward so I can be among the coral, the bigger fish, and the occasional reef shark. I get to be part of their world for those rare, precious, magical moments. Finally, I hear the faint sound of the horn from the boat, signaling us to return aboard so we can head back to land. By the end of 2017, that bleaching event that I was witnessing firsthand, some scientists said the Great Barrier Reef was damaged beyond repair and could no longer be saved. Others declared the reef to be in its, quote, terminal stage. A plan by the Australian government to protect the reef was deemed, quote, no longer achievable. The year 2017 ended up being the hottest year ever recorded for Earth's oceans, making that year and the four before it the top 5 hottest years on record for the oceans. The bleaching event in 2017 ended up striking 30% of the reef. And then last year, 2018, that bleaching event took out another 20% of the reef. And the leading coral scientists in Australia estimate that the reef has less than 10 years left. I want to step back and give some broad brushstrokes of the macro of how far along we are in the climate crisis now. After 9 years of in-depth reporting and going to these different places around the world with a lot of the leading scientists in these areas and watching consistently the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projections be shown for what they are, their worst-case projections aren't even keeping a pace with observational reality. What I see is that it's far too late to avert a global environmental catastrophe. Obviously, stopping it is off the table. Mitigating it is still out there in the ether as a remote possibility, but adaptation is what is upon us now. 2018 was the fourth warmest year ever recorded, with the only warmer years being 2015, 2016, and 2017. This past June was the hottest June ever recorded. Last month, July, was the hottest month ever recorded, period, on Earth since record-keeping began. We're currently in the middle of what is on track to be the warmest decade since record-keeping began. We're already in the sixth mass extinction event that industrial civilization has caused. We're injecting CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate 10 times faster than what occurred during the Permian mass extinction event 252 million years ago that annihilated 90% of life on Earth. Our current extinction rate is 1,000 times faster than normal and is faster than that of the Permian mass extinction.
And here we must pause part one of Dar Jamail's wide-ranging talk on the climate crisis. Thanks again to Wilton Vaught for the audio recording. You can find Vaught's work in video and in audio in outlets including YouTube, iTunes, and radioforall.net. Just do a search for Essential Dissent. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. New World Notes .blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum. Let's try to live each day as though the truth were true. And please come back again for part two of Dar Jamail next week. Till then.